and the time of the patriarchs. Before that, let's review a little bit of last week's lesson. Last week, we examined various creation and flood myths from Mesopotamia and Egypt. We ended our time by asking if Israel could have borrowed from its neighbors to compose the creation and flood accounts of Genesis. But we said confidently, no, Israel did not. We discussed four reasons for why we can know that, why we know Israel did not borrow creation and flood accounts from its neighbors. What was one of those reasons? Yeah, Craig.
The Bible is true.
Yeah, the Bible's true. God has shown us the Word of God is true. He's revealed us reality through the Bible. So obviously we're going to say, no, this is the source. What else? What did we make note of last week as we looked at the creation myths and flood myths? It helps us see that Israel did not borrow. Yeah, Eric. That's right. There are some similarities, but there are also many, many differences, particularly in the details, but also fundamental differences, differences in worldview. Things like the world is getting better versus the world is getting worse, or the gods are needy and cruel and whimsical versus God is perfect and in total control. And then also we mentioned that myths tend to get more elaborate and less believable over time, rather than simpler and more believable over time. So as the Bible was written later than these myths, it doesn't make sense that the Bible would be simpler and more reasonable. So we have a number of reasons for why Israel did not borrow. And I also said there's a better explanation for the similarities we see between the Bible's accounts and these myths. What is the better explanation? Go ahead, Bill. Exactly. The better explanation is that the events of the Bible actually happened, and memories of those events were showing up in the myths and legends of other nations, of other cultures. That's a better explanation. Any questions about what we talked about last week? Yeah, Steve.
Just a comment. Just looking at these other ones, it seems like the Bible is the only reasonable explanation out of all of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, factual occurrences with, of course, you know, some literature. You know, I mean, you always use word pictures and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems like it's the only one that's very, very reasonable and believable.
Yeah, that's a good comment, Steve. Not only the events that take place are reasonable, the events of the Bible are reasonable, much more reasonable than these myths, but even the way it's presented is reasonable. That it's presented as a sequence of events in history rather than a very poetic and very mythological-sounding epic, which is the way it's presented in these other accounts. Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah, Roy.
Just a general comment. I guess comment/question. Wouldn't it be more accurate to say that, for lack of a better way to say it, that the Gentile nations borrowed from scriptural truth as it was passed down and they distorted it? Wouldn't that be more accurate?
Yeah, I think that is a good way to describe it, your question. Would it be more accurate to say that the Gentile nations, those other nations, actually borrowed from the Bible? Yes, in a sense. They weren't necessarily looking at the scriptures, but the true events of the Bible, they are taking those events and they've become a little bit distorted or they've communicated them in a way that corresponds to their own worldview. But yeah, in a sense, it's the other nations actually borrowing from the true account, which is presented in the Bible. Other questions or comments? Okay, so we've looked at archaeology related to the first 1,700 years of history, from creation around 4,000 BC to the flood around 2350 BC. But now we're going to look at the period from 2350 BC to 1900 BC, about 1900 BC, from Babel to the birth of Isaac and to the destruction of Sodom. I told you last week that we don't have very many archaeological pieces of information from before the flood. The flood destroyed the information that would have been available. After the flood, there's a lot more, but not very much about Abraham. As of today, we have not discovered any direct evidence of Abraham in the Middle East. But this is not surprising, actually, considering the lifestyle of Abraham. Even though the Bible tells us Abraham was very rich, what kind of house did he live in? He lived in a tent. Remember, he lived in a tent. And Abraham tended to move around a lot. Why? Yeah, because he was a herder. He was somebody who took care of livestock. When they constantly need fresh sources of food, green pastures, and so he's going to be moving around the land of Canaan. And even going into Egypt sometimes. He was a nomad. And when you live as a nomad, as Abraham did, you tend not to leave much behind that directly identifies you. I mean, he embodies what the New Testament says. He was living a very temporary life. He was a sojourner. He didn't leave much evidence behind that directly identified him. So because of that, can we say nothing about Abraham or his time period based on archaeology? Actually, far from it. We have a large amount of archaeological information related to the period in which Abraham lived. Today, we're just going to focus on a few of those things, because, after all, this is just a survey. We can't talk about everything. Today's outline is basically presented in the title for today. First, in our lesson today, we're going to look at evidence for Babel. Second, we're going to look for confirmation of early Semitic life and customs based off of pieces of evidence from Mesopotamia and Egypt. And then third, we're going to look at Sodom. Lord willing, if we have time today. We won't be able to talk all the way about Sodom, but we can say some things, because the infamous city has been found. Or has it? We're going to investigate. Let's pray before we go further. Lord God, we thank you that you are the God of history, that you're not like the other gods, that you've given us a history that is true and that is so complete, giving us exactly what we need to know so we can understand where we fit in the world, where we fit in history, and what you're doing. Lord, help me to be able to explain well today and help those listening to be able to pay attention. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, first we're going to go back to Babel. Open your Bibles. Let's reread the short account given in Babel in Genesis 11. So it's Genesis 11, verses 1 to 9. Starting in verse 1, Genesis 11, verses 1 to 9. Now the whole earth used the same language and the same words. It came about, as they journeyed east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. They said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly." And they used brick for stone, and they used tar for mortar. They said, "Come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven, and let us make for ourselves a name. Otherwise, we'll be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth." The Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. The Lord said, "Behold, they are one people, and they all have the same language. And this is what they began to do, and now nothing which they purpose to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and there confuse their language, so that they will not understand one another's speech." So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. Therefore its name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the whole earth. Okay, with that in mind, let's talk about some archaeology. Is there archaeology that can tell us about the building of Babel and the confusion of languages? Is there archaeological evidence? Well, as you know from our recent class on Babel, we can get some idea of the Tower of Babel's appearance and purpose by looking at the many ancient towers in Mesopotamia, in the area in which Babel would have existed. What do we call these towers? Ziggurats. Ziggurats. The Tower of Babel was the first tower in the Middle East after the flood, so it likely became the template for all the monumental towers that were built later in the Middle East by the people of the Middle East in just the first few centuries after the Tower of Babel. It makes sense, then, to look at those preceding towers, those towers that came right afterwards, the ziggurats, to try and get a sense of the Tower of Babel. So I actually have two ziggurats pictured up there, two entrances of those ziggurats. Archaeologists have discovered almost 30 ziggurats in Mesopotamia, and all generally conform to the pattern of various terraces leading up to a central point at the top of the structure. These ziggurats also had ramps, stairs, or sometimes both, leading up to the top. Now, for what were ziggurats used in Mesopotamia? There's actually much debate among archaeologists about this. The ziggurats clearly had something to do with religion. John Walton from the Associates of Biblical Research, a biblical archaeology organization and a Christian organization, has proposed using the names of the ziggurats themselves to point us to their purpose. We actually know the names that the Mesopotamians used for many of their ziggurats because of ancient inscriptions. Let me show you some of them, and let's see if we can notice any patterns. These are 15 names of ziggurats. We have the Temple of the Foundation of Heaven and Earth, the Temple of the Wielder of the Seven Decrees of Heaven and Earth, Temple of the Mountain Breeze, Temple of Mystery, Temple of the Stairway to Pure Heaven, Temple of the God Dadia, Temple of the Admirable Throne or Sanctuary, Temple of the Ziggurat, Exalted Dwelling Place, Temple of the Exalted Mountain, Temple of Exalted Splendor, Temple of the God Nana, Temple of the Foundation of Heaven and Earth, Temple which links Heaven and Earth, Temple of the Gipuru, and Temple of the Ziggurat. Okay, what repeated ideas or themes do you notice in these titles? Yeah, Roy. Temple, right? Sometimes they all include the name temple. Yeah, Craig.
Exalted, place.
Exalted. There's the idea of glory or exaltation with these structures. What else? Rob. Okay, there's the theme of heaven and earth. And some of them even say there's a connection, that the temple has to do with a connection between heaven and earth. We have stairs and also a link. What else? Okay, there are certain gods associated with these temple names. Anything else? Yeah, Craig. Two of them say foundation. Oh, we have two of the exact same name here. What do you know? Temple of the Foundation of Heaven and Earth. Hopefully I didn't just copy one twice. But yeah, we have the foundation. Also, there's the idea of mountain, you may have noticed. A number of these talk about mountains or mention the name mountain. So we can put these things together, get a little bit of an idea of, based on the names, the purpose of these structures. The ziggurat was going to act like a glorious mountain that interacted with both heaven and earth, even linked heaven and earth, linking heaven, the dwelling place of the gods, with earth, the dwelling place of men. That's what these ziggurats were for. This idea may figure in to the Tower of Babel account that we just read about, because the tower, besides as acting as a monument to man's wisdom, ability, and strength, it would act like a link between heaven and earth, either to bring man up to God or to bring God down to man. We see this link between heaven and earth even in the names of the ziggurats. It's intriguing to note, however, that in ancient documents describing religious rituals in Mesopotamia, ziggurats are actually not involved in those rituals. People might refer to the ziggurat, they might praise the god of the ziggurat, they might swear by the ziggurat, but strangely, so far we have found no evidence that people or priests are ever described as using the ziggurat as part of religious rituals. They didn't go up the ziggurat, they didn't do anything on the ziggurat. Therefore, John Walton, the man I mentioned earlier, he suggests that the ziggurat, at least in post-Babel times, was only supposed to be used by the gods. It wasn't for man to use. It was just for the gods to use. The ziggurat was a stairway, indeed, but not for man. It was for the gods. It was for the gods as they traveled from heaven to earth and vice versa. Moreover, the gods could refresh themselves on this stairway with food, drink, and a place to rest, provided by the pious worshippers of those gods, the people of the city. That seems to be the purpose of the ziggurat. One other note regarding ziggurats. Ziggurats were built of the same building materials mentioned here in this passage. In Genesis 11, the materials mentioned by Moses are tar, or some translations say bitumen, which is a petroleum product that is found to have existed in Mesopotamia in various places, and burned brick, or baked brick. Brick that has been burned with a furnace instead of sun-dried. There are two main ways that you can make brick, either in a kiln, a furnace, or you could just leave it out in the sun, let the sun dry it. Baked brick and bitumen were valuable materials in ancient Mesopotamia, and they were reserved for public buildings and monuments. You wouldn't use it just to build your house. You wouldn't use those materials. They're too expensive. They're too valuable. They would use them for public buildings, though, which usually included the two central structures of any city, which were the ziggurat, and the palace of the king. Those are the buildings that would get baked brick and bitumen. Because baked brick and the joining mechanism of bitumen, though expensive, they're very strong. Even stronger than naturally cut stone or iron. Ziggurats were often constructed using outer walls of baked brick, and then inside it would be filled with dirt and reinforced with mud brick. So the most important parts of the foundation, the outer walls, they used baked brick. So this consistency also helps us see that Tower of Babel was probably a ziggurat. Now, if the Tower of Babel was the original ziggurat, is it possible then that one of the ziggurats that we've uncovered today is actually the Tower of Babel? I mean, if the Tower of Babel was a ziggurat, we're finding all these ziggurats, maybe the Tower of Babel is one of those ziggurats. Does it still exist? It is possible. This is actually the theory of some archaeologists, including David Roll. We'll talk about this particular archaeologist at more length in later classes, because he's one of those people who wants to turn around Egyptian chronology. He's one of those who suggests that we've got it all wrong. He's not a Christian, but he is a maximalist. He's someone that believes the Bible gives accurate archaeological information. His theory is that the ziggurat of Amarsin in ancient Eridu, the ancient city of Eridu, is actually the Tower of Babel. That ziggurat is the oldest and largest of all the uncovered ziggurats. Though there's some debate as to which ziggurat is actually the largest, because what qualifies as a ziggurat? And, you know, it's a little bit difficult to date things, and so there's some debate about which one is actually oldest. But this is one of the oldest, the ziggurat of Amarsin. Actually, I don't have a picture of it, but the ziggurat of Amarsin. Moreover, in the Mesopotamian tradition, Eridu was the first city and the first great city built in ancient Sumer, in ancient Mesopotamia. You remember the Sumerian king list that we looked at last week? Well, the first line from that chronicle reads thusly: after the kingship descended from heaven, the kingship was in Eridu, or Eridu. So they said, kingship came down to this city, Eridu, from heaven. Additionally, certain terms that later referred to the city of Babylon were first used to describe the city of Eridu. So there's actually a link between Babylon and Eridu. They were sometimes talked about the same way. Finally, there's a curious mentioning of confused languages and the god of Eridu in the Sumerian myth Enmerkar and the lord of Arata. This story, dated to around 2100 BC, is all about the feud that the ruler of Uruk and Eridu, a ruler by the name of Enmerkar, is having with this lord of another city, a city named Arata. At one point in their feud, it's kind of like a battle of wits. At one point in their feud, Enmerkar invokes a spell on his rival by reciting an incantation. Now, let me show you one translation of the spell, two excerpts. This is Enmerkar speaking. Once upon a time, there was no snake, there was no scorpion, there was no hyena, there was no lion, there was no wild dog, no wolf, there was no fear, no terror, man had no rival. In those days, the lands of Suber and Hamazi, harmony-tongued Sumer, the great land of the decrees of princeship, Uri, the land having all that is appropriate, the land Martu, resting in security, the whole universe, the people in unison, to Enlil, the chief god, in one tongue, spoke. Then Enki, he's the god of crafts, water, and creation, also the patron god of Eridu, the lord of abundance, whose commands are trustworthy, the lord of wisdom, who understands the land, the leader of the gods, endowed with wisdom, the lord of Eridu changed the speech in their mouths, brought contention into it, into the speech of man that until then had been one. Okay, if this translation is correct, this is a clear reference to the confusion of languages at Babel. I mean, it's very, very clear. Could the Babel of Genesis 11 actually have been ancient Eridu? After all, the god of Eridu is said to be the one who confused the languages. We should note, there are other ways to translate this passage in this myth. For instance, other versions of this spell have it taking place in the future rather than in the past. And it's a unification of languages rather than a confusion of languages. That is, Enki, will one day make all the languages of man one. And that's what he's invoking here. Enki, make the languages of all the people one. So it's possible that there's a different translation necessary. Either way, what's significant is that the god of Eridu is described as having power over human language, either to confuse or to unite. Now, one problem with Eridu being in ancient Babel is that Eridu is pretty far south. It's still technically part of Mesopotamia, but it's, if you think of the two rivers of Mesopotamia, Babel would be kind of in the middle towards the top. Eridu is down here at the bottom, over this river. So would the people, after leaving the Ark, have traveled that far south before they got together to build a city and a tower? That's a good question. But even if the ziggurat of Eridu was not the original Tower of Babel, it is possible that the Tower of Babel, because it may have only partially been completed, the tower was later finished, reused, or repurposed in the work of other Mesopotamian dwellers. So part of the Tower of Babel may have become one of the ziggurats that we've uncovered today. It'd be hard to figure out which one, but it is possible. That's what I want to say about Babel. Any questions about Babel and its archaeology? Yeah, Roy. That's a good observation, just to repeat your comment, that Jacob has the dream and he sees the ladder or the stairway with the angels going up and down it from heaven to earth. That certainly sounds a little bit like the way the Mesopotamians thought of their ziggurats functioning like a stairway. I'm not exactly sure what the proper explanation of that connection is, or if indeed they are related, but yeah, that certainly sounds similar. Other comments or questions? Yes, Steve.
Is the date 2100 BC, is that pretty accurate, or is that a dispute?
That's a good question. I don't know for sure. But when the consensus right now is that this story, this myth, originated from around 2100 BC. I remember, it's always with an asterisk. But yeah, that's what archaeologists think. That would be after the Tower of Babel, of course, because the Tower of Babel would take place around 2240 BC. And that would, if indeed that's a correct date, that's not very long after the Tower of Babel. So that could be a very recent memory. But as the people were dispersing in Mesopotamia, that myth was written. Other questions or comments? Okay, so we've heard a little bit about Babel. Now the next place the text goes in the Bible is to Abraham. It moves across a large period of, or a pretty decent chunk of time, and it goes to Abram, or Abraham, first called Abram. Again, we don't have direct evidence of Abraham himself in archaeology. His name does not appear on any inscriptions that we found thus far. But we do have a number of pieces of information that relate to the time of Abraham and to the customs of that time. So it can help us understand Abraham a little bit better. First, let's take a look at the story of Sinuhi. I'll show you a little bit of the archaeological information we have. The story of Sinuhi. This story comes to us from various surviving papyri fragments from around 1800 BC, though the story appears to have been composed around 2000 BC. So this would be probably written during the time of Abraham or his immediate descendants. The story describes the experience of an Egyptian official named Sinuhi, who after the death of a certain pharaoh, flees Egypt and lives somewhere in Canaan. There, a tent-dwelling chieftain named Enshi, the son of Amu, befriends Sinuhi and makes Sinuhi a leader of the tribe. At one point in the story, Sinuhi describes the land and a little bit of the daily life of the tribal group that he's in. So this would be helpful for giving us some context to the Bible. Let's see what Sinuhi has to say. And he, Enshi, placed me even before his children and mated me with his eldest daughter, that is, married. He caused me to choose for myself of his country, of the best that belonged to him, on his border to another country. It was a goodly land called Yah. Figs were in it, and grapes, and its wine was more abundant than its water. Plentiful was its honey, and many were its olives. All manner of fruits were upon its trees. Wheat was in it, and spelt, which is a kind of wheat, and limitless cattle of all kinds. Great also was that which fell to my portion by reason of the love bestowed on me. He made me ruler of a tribe of the best of his country. Food was provided provided me for my daily fare, and wine for my daily portion, cooked meat and roast, fowl, over and above the animals of the desert, for men hunted and laid before me in addition to the quarry of my dogs. And there was made for me many dainties and milk, prepared in every way. Hopefully you've had breakfast, that might make you a little bit hungry. How does Sinihi describe the land of Canaan, which he calls Yah? Bountiful, right? This is an abundant land, abundant in good food and good drink. Do you notice any descriptions here that actually sound like the Bible's descriptions of Canaan? It's flowing with honey, right? It says plentiful was its honey, and it also mentions milk at the end. In the phrase that's often repeated in the Bible about Canaan, it's a land flowing with milk and honey. And also you remember that when the spies come back from Canaan, they bring back grapes. And so we've got grapes and wine and a number of other fruits mentioned here. So when God brought Abraham to Canaan, even before his descendants came into the promised land, Canaan was, according to Sinihi, it was an abundant land. And as a wealthy chieftain, as a wealthy leader of his group, his tribe, as a tent dweller, Abraham probably enjoyed a similar lifestyle to that described by Sinihi here. Got to enjoy the abundance of the land, and he had many servants providing abundant food from the animals and plants around the land. We actually get more about the life of the Asiatics, that's what the Egyptians called Middle Eastern people, from Egyptian art. So not just the stories that Egyptians circulated, this apparently was a very popular story, by the way, the story of Sinihi, but also some of the Egyptian art. I'd like to show you a painting. It's also on the handout, if you picked up the handout today. This painting is from the wall of a tomb of Khnumhotep II, a great chief of one of Egypt's districts. It's not a pharaoh, but as you'll learn a little bit later on, pharaohs were not always the absolute rulers of Egypt. There was a time where actually power was more decentralized and you had more regional chiefs. This is one of them, Khnumhotep II. His tomb is in Beni Hassan, which is an Egyptian cemetery in modern-day Minya, Egypt. So think, if you think of where Egypt is, near Egypt's geographic center would be where this tomb is. And according to archaeologists, this cemetery was in use during Egypt's Middle Kingdom period, from approximately 2100 BC to 1600 BC. So this cemetery would be in use during the time of Abraham and the patriarchs. Khnumhotep specifically is thought to have lived around 2000 BC, so that would have been very close to Abraham's lifespan. The main room of Khnumhotep's tomb features various paintings serving as a biography of the ruler's life and accomplishments. Basically, you look at all the pictures and you say, oh, this is what he did. That's what he did. Wow, what a great guy. This painting that I'm showing you on the screen in two parts is particularly interesting because of the figures depicted. Okay, maybe you can see it a little bit on the screen, but hopefully also reinforce that with the handout. You may notice in this picture that there are two figures that don't match the rest. Why don't they match? Yeah, Andrew. Yeah, those two figures there in the top right, they have darker skin than the rest of the group. What else is different about them? Yeah, Rob. Yeah. Yeah, like a skirt thing. Yeah, they have different clothes than the rest of the group. Well, those two figures are actually Egyptians. So, if those two figures are Egyptians, what must the other figures be? They're likely not Egyptians. In fact, the writing next to this painting identifies the group as consisting of 37 individuals with a foreign chieftain by the name of Abishai. Now, what ethnicity is the name Abishai? That sounds like a Hebrew name. It's a Semitic name. It's someone from the descendants of Shem. So what we're looking at here is probably a group of Semitic travelers. They could be Canaanite, they could be Amorite, they could be Hebrew. But they've come to Egypt and apparently were delivering some kind of tribute or some offering to this great chief of Egypt. So if we study this picture, we can get a sense a little bit of the fashion and lifestyle of the Semites during this period, including even Abraham. So let's see if we can study some of the details here. What do you notice about these people? Yeah, Magda. They have facial hair. They have beards, but no mustache. So apparently that was the fashion, have this beard, but no mustache. What else? Yeah, Steve. They do, when we think about their transportation, we do see some animals here. So we know that they're using donkeys there at the bottom. It looks like some sort of goat, elk, antelope type things at the top. Though they're not using them as pack animals, they're probably gifts, maybe some kind of offering. Also notice that they're not riding any of the animals, except for, you can see down there in the bottom right, two little kids. Two little kids sitting on that donkey. So that gives us some idea of their transportation practices. Everyone walks except for the little kids. And you put your stuff on the pack animals. Men and women and older children, they walk. What else do we notice? Yeah, Dwayne. That's right. We see some of the weapons here. There's a spears. There's a bow. I don't know if you can see it with the glare in the screen, but there's probably some throwing sticks. I don't know if you know what that is, but a throwing stick is kind of like a mix between a club and a boomerang. It was actually a stick that you could hit things with, but also throw it. It was good for hunting. And maybe an axe here also. So we get some idea of the weaponry. Yeah, Danielle, what else?
It looks like some of them are wearing shoes and others aren't.
That's right. Who's wearing the shoes?
I guess the Semitic tribe.
Well, yeah, the Egyptians are actually not wearing anything. But among the Semitic group, some of them are wearing shoes, some of them are wearing sandals. Who's wearing the sandals? The men. Apparently the men are wearing the sandals, and it was fashionable for the women to wear something like a moccasin. They were wearing shoes. We can say more here, but just for the sake of time, I'll try to go through it a little bit. Notice that they have different skin color. The Egyptians often depicted the Asiatics as having yellow skin. They have dark hair. Facial hair is a little bit different. Mode of transportation we talked about. Weapons, clothing. The women are wearing white headbands. They are all wearing colorful robes that are about knee length, but only going over one shoulder. Talked about the footwear. You can also see that there's a stringed instrument here in the bottom left. The guy's playing something like a lyre or a harp, and he's wearing a canteen. So we have a little snapshot of Semitic life, of fashion, transportation, warfare, during the time of Abraham and the patriarchs. What we're seeing probably reflects, in at least some way, the way that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob themselves actually looked and functioned during that time. That's a good question. That could be a scroll. I'm not really sure. That object between the two kids there. Yeah, good question. So Egypt tells us a little bit about Abraham and the patriarchs, that time period, but also does Mesopotamia, especially when it comes to the law and customs. So we see some things from Egypt. Let's look what Mesopotamia can tell us. Let's actually look at some passages in the Bible once again. You may remember that in the account of Abraham, some strange things happen regarding marriage and inheritance. Look at Genesis 16. They may seem strange to us. Genesis 16, verses 1 to 6, just to refresh you some of the things that happened between Abraham and Sarah. Look at Genesis 16, verse 1. Now Sarah, Abraham's wife, had borne him no children, and she had an Egyptian maid whose name was Hagar. So Sarah said to Abram, "Now behold, the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Please go in to my maid. Perhaps I will obtain children through her." And Abram listened to the voice of Sarai. After Abram had lived 10 years in the land of Canaan, Abram's wife Sarai took Hagar the Egyptian, her maid, and gave her to her husband Abram as his wife. He went into Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress was despised in her sight. And Sarai said to Abram, "May the wrong done me be upon you. I gave my maid into your arms, but when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her sight. May the Lord judge between you and me." But Abram said to Sarai, "Behold, your maid is in your power. Do to her what is good in your sight." So Sarai treated her harshly, and she fled from her presence. Okay, a lot of things happening here, but first of all, this idea of, okay, I don't have a kid, so I'll just give you another wife. Sarai, where did you get that idea? Are you crazy? Why are you giving your maidservant to Abraham as a concubine? Later on, Sarai does something else that seems a little bit strange. Turn to Genesis 21. Genesis 21, and let's look at verses 9 to 14. This is after Sarah has given birth to Isaac. And of course, Hagar is also has a son by Abraham at this point. Look at verse 9. Now Sarah saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, mocking. Therefore she said to Abraham, "Drive out this maid and her son, for the son of this maid shall not be an heir with my son Isaac." The matter distressed Abraham greatly because of his son. But God said to Abraham, "Do not be distressed because of the lad and your maid. Whatever Sarah tells you, listen to her. For through Isaac your descendant shall be named. And of the son of the maid I will make a nation also, because he is your descendant." So Abraham arose early in the morning and took bread and a skin of water and gave them to Hagar, putting them on her shoulder, and gave her the boy and sent her away. And she departed and wandered about in the wilderness of Beersheba. This decision from Abraham and Sarah to drive out Hagar and her son may seem a little cruel to us. What's going on here? Well, some cultural context, I think, will help. First, regarding taking new wives, listen to this contract from the Nuzi cache. At Nuzi, the ancient city of Nuzi, there was a collection of about 5,000 Mesopotamian records on tablets. Nuzi is in northern Mesopotamia. These tablets date from approximately, or they cover dates from 2000 BC to about 1000 BC. Here's an excerpt from one of the adoption contracts that included a provision about marriage. Furthermore, Kelemninu has been given in marriage to Shanima. If Kelemninu bears children, so Kelemninu is a female, Shanima shall not take another wife. But if Kelemninu does not bear, Kelemninu shall acquire a woman of the land of Lulu as wife for Shanima, and Kelemninu may not send the offspring away. Any sons that may be born to Shanima from the womb of Kelemninu, to these sons shall be given all the land and building of every sort. However, if she does not bear a son, then the daughter of Kelemninu from the land and the building shall take one portion of the property. We could say a few things about this, but basically at one point I want to highlight, we have a woman being given in marriage here, but if she doesn't bear her husband any children, what is that woman's responsibility? What's Kelemninu supposed to do if she doesn't give any children to her husband? Provide another wife for her husband. That's pretty intense, right? You don't give me any kids, you have to go get me another wife. Other Mesopotamian contracts actually have similar provisions. There's one where it says, if the wife did not conceive, then the wife's brother has to provide another wife. Or another one says that if the wife did not conceive, the husband was free to take another wife. I guess after a certain period of time, the wife didn't conceive, you can take another wife, husband. And this wasn't just part of the contractual agreements that we see from places like Nuzi. We even see this in the law. The famous Code of Hammurabi features various provisions regarding childless wives. Now, this law code, you may have heard of it, this Mesopotamian law code is featured on a stone steel dated to approximately 1750 BC, discovered in 1901 by Jean-Vincent Scheil. Other copies of this ancient law code have been found. By the way, some skeptics for a long time dismissed the claim that Moses had written the Pentateuch because they said people were not writing at that time. Israelites did not have access to writing, let alone lawmaking. That's impossible during that time period. But then this was discovered, the Code of Hammurabi in 1750. Even older than the Pentateuch, so that put those objections to rest. Anyways, this steel, you can kind of see it there, shaped like an index finger, currently on display in the Louvre, though there are reproductions of it around the world, big stone slab with inscriptions describing the law code, giving the law code. All right, what provisions about marriage and childless wives does this law have? Let's look at a few of those provisions. Law 144. If a man take a wife and this woman give her husband a maidservant and she bear him children, but this man wishes to take another wife, it shall not be permitted to him. He shall not take a second wife. He's already got two, basically. 145. If a man take a wife and she bear him no children and he intend to take another wife, if he take this second wife and bring her into the house, the second wife shall not be allowed equality with the first, or with his wife. Law 146. If a man take a wife, and she give this man a maidservant as wife, and she, the maidservant, bear him children, and then this maid assume equality with the wife because she has borne him children, her master shall not sell her for money, but he may keep her as a slave, reckoning her among the maidservants. If she have not borne him children, Law 147, then her mistress may sell her for money. Okay. So we see some aspects of our biblical text actually reflected in these laws. Childlessness is recognized in these laws as a cause for what? What's that? That's right. It's recognized that if you're in a situation where your wife is childless, a man may take another wife. But if he has children, then he's not supposed to do that. He can take another wife, or his wife can give him a maidservant, that is, a female slave, to bear children for her husband. We also see it's apparently a common issue that once the female slave bears a child, what does she often do? Assumes equality with his actual wife. The slave will often assume equality with the first wife. If such a situation were to occur in Hammurabi's law, that situation is not an excuse for the husband to do what? It says he specifically may not do this. He cannot sell the slave. Once that slave has given you a child, you may not sell her. You can continue to treat her as a slave, but you cannot get rid of her. If she hasn't given you any children, though, you can get rid of her. You can sell her for money. So we can see already how Abraham and Sarah's actions are consistent with some of the customs of the time. They saw a situation where there was no children, and Sarah probably thinking, according to the same mindset that was around, that, okay, I need to provide some other way for my husband to have children. I'll give him my maidservant. It wasn't that strange in that time period. But of course, that does not excuse what she's done, what she asked to do. Her lack of faith in the Lord, her violation of the one man, one woman marriage design that was evident since the beginning of creation in Adam and Eve. She was being conformed to the thinking of the world. But what about Abraham and Sarah's driving Hagar and Ishmael away? Again, we see there are parts of Mesopotamian law that have to do with exactly that situation. Let me show you another law code, the Code of Lipit-Ishtar. Actually, a little bit earlier than the Code of Hammurabi. This one comes from around 1850 BC, discovered in the ancient city of Nippur in Iraq in 1899. There are two laws from this code that have to do with marriage and inheritance. Look at Law 24. If this second wife, whom he had married, bore him children, the dowry which she brought from her father's house belongs to her children, but the children of his first wife and the children of his second wife shall divide equally the property of their father. Okay, basically this law is saying, if you've got two wives, the first wife, whatever dowry she had, that goes to her kids, but in terms of the inheritance from the father, that has to be split. It has to be split among the children. That is exactly the situation that Sarah does not want to have happen in the Bible. She says, this son will not be an heir with my son. I don't want that. She doesn't want Law 24 to apply. Let's look at Law 25. If a man married a wife, and she bore him children, and those children are living, and a slave also bore children for her master, but the father granted freedom to the slave and her children, the children of the slave shall not divide the estate with the children of their former master. Okay, so according to this law, a couple would be free from dividing an inheritance between the wife's son and a slave woman's son if the couple did what? If they set free the slave woman and her children. So you don't have to give them a part in the inheritance if you grant them their freedom. That was the law, according to Lipit-Ishtar. We actually see the same type of provision in the Code of Hammurabi also. Law 170. If his wife bear sons to a man, or his maidservant have born sons, so you have wife and maidservant, both with children, and the father, while still living, says to the children whom his maidservant has born, my sons, and he count them with the sons of his wife, if then the father die, then the sons of the wife and the maidservant shall divide the paternal property in common. The son of the wife is to partition and choose. If, however, the father, while still living, did not say to the sons of my maidservant, my sons, and then the father dies, then the sons of the maidservant shall not share with the sons of the wife, but the freedom of the maid and her sons shall be granted. The sons of the wife shall have no right to enslave the sons of the maid. So actually, from these laws, from these customs, we can see that Sarah's request to Abraham to send Hagar and Ishmael away is consistent with the time period. Abraham had probably grown to love Ishmael, so the idea did displease him, but God confirms the rightness of Sarah's request. God's covenant blessings to Abraham were only going to be inherited by one son. God did not want there to be any confusion regarding the real line of inheritance, so therefore God said, grant the freedom of Hagar and her children and send them away, which is exactly what they do. When he puts the jar and gives her the bread, or when he puts the jar in Hagar and gives her the bread, he's granting her freedom. That's likely what's going on there. So, again, not direct evidence of Abraham, but we understand more about what the Bible says about Abraham just from other pieces of evidence from the time. Questions about marriage and inheritance customs in ancient Mesopotamia and Egypt? That's a good way to restate the point, Bill. Just to restate what you said, that in fiction, we often see a discrepancy between what's depicted in the story and the customs and behavior of people in the real world. But we're seeing that the Bible is completely consistent with historical information of customs at the time, laws, customs, and descriptions at the time. So that does make the Bible even more credible. Other comments or questions? Greg.
I'm just going to point out that, Genesis was written by Moses. It was, hundreds of years after the custom of all the been displaced by Egyptians dominated.
Yeah, so that makes it even more credible because it's accurate even when Moses wasn't there. Moses is not simply describing the customs of his time. He's describing customs that were from centuries before his time. And it may have even been different in Moses' time. But yeah, that's a good point. Other questions or comments? All right, so we've looked at Babel. We've looked a little bit at Abraham. Now something related to Abraham, with our last bit of time today, let's start talking about Sodom. You remember Sodom, Gomorrah, infamous cities of sinful perversion destroyed by God with fire, according to Genesis 19. Well, remarkably, as I said, Sodom has been found. Yes, we have ruins today that bear evidence that they were supernaturally destroyed by fire, just as God shows us in the book of Genesis. But there's a problem. There are actually two sets of ruins that could be Sodom, with archaeologists of each dig claiming that their site is the real Sodom. The other one's not. Oh boy. Let's see if we can make sense of this. I'm going to present to you, partially this week, more next week, information about both sites, and then the evidence for and against each site as the real site for Sodom. These sites are remarkable, but let's see how well they line up with evidence. First, we need to look at some biblical background. What does the Bible say about Sodom's location and how it was destroyed? Now, this is going to come kind of quickly, so follow along with me as I point you to different references. First place that Sodom is mentioned in the Bible is Genesis 10. Genesis 10:19. This is part of the Table of the Nations. This is what it says. The territory of the Canaanite extended from Sidon as you go toward Gerar as far as Gaza, as you go toward Sodom and Gomorrah and Admah and Zeboim as far as Lasha. Right, this verse is talking about the borders of the Canaanites' dwelling, the borders of Canaan, essentially. On the west, you have Sidon and Gaza. That'd be like the northern and southern boundaries on the west side. On the east, you have Sodom, Gomorrah, Admah, and Zeboim. So Sodom, according to this verse, is apparently on the eastern border of Canaanite territory. Sodom and these associated cities, they form an eastern border to Canaanite territory. Then Sodom disappears for a little bit in the narrative and appears again in Genesis 13. Jump over there. Genesis 13, 10 to 12. This is when Abram and Lot decide to split up. Look at verse 10. Lot lifted up his eyes and saw all the valley of the Jordan. It was well watered everywhere. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, as you go to Zoar. So Lot chose for himself all the valley of the Jordan, and Lot journeyed eastward. Thus they separated from each other. Abram settled in the land of Canaan, while Lot settled in the cities of the valley and moved his tents as far as Sodom. Okay, so this episode, this viewing of the valley or of the plain by Lot, as he's trying to figure out, where do I want to live? This takes place at a site between Bethel and Ai. That's where Abram and Lot are in this passage, between Bethel and Ai. And Lot looks at the valley, which is also translated plain, and he decides to settle there. According to this passage, why? Why does Lot decide, that looks like a good place for me to live? Yeah, it looks great. It looks green. It looks well-watered. A couple of descriptions there, like the garden of the Lord, like the garden of Egypt. So Lot must have been able to see from that place between Bethel and Ai, clearly, the well-watered nature of the valley of the Jordan. Now, Sodom was part of that. Now, the text also says that Lot journeyed which way to get to the land that he chose. He went east. It says he went eastward. Okay, a couple notes. Sodom is viewable from Bethel and Ai. He travels eastward. It was very well watered, and it was part of the valley or the plain of the Jordan. Sodom is mentioned again in the next chapter, Genesis 14. War comes to Sodom and the surrounding area. Look at Genesis 14, verses 1 to 3. We'll make some more observations. And it came about in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of Goyim, that they made war with Bera, king of Sodom, and with Bersha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, and Shemeber, king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar. All these came as allies to the valley of Siddim, that is the Salt Sea. Okay, this is not the first time we've heard these cities, most of them. Sodom was allied, apparently, with the cities that had previously been mentioned. Gomorrah, Admah, Zeboim, and then Bela, is like a new city, is also included, also called Zoar. Now, look further down in this passage, or maybe just remember, how does the battle go for Sodom? What was the result? They lost. Sodom was defeated. Look at verses 10 to 12. Now the valley of Siddim was full of tar pits, and the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled, and they fell into them. But those who survived fled to the hill country. Then they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their food supply and departed. They also took Lot, Abram's nephew, and his possessions and departed, for he was living in Sodom. So this battle, notice, took place in the valley of Siddim. Part of the fleeing from the battle tells us a little bit about a geographic feature. What is part of the Valley of Siddim? Tar pits. They fell into these tar pits, these fleeing kings. Also can be translated bitumen pits. What appears to take place immediately after the defeat of Sodom in battle? What do the victorious soldiers do? They plunder the city of Sodom. They sack it. They take away the goods, and they take away Lot. Okay, we want to note those details. Sodom was allied with the cities mentioned in Genesis 10:19. There's a battle in the valley of Siddim near some bitumen pits, and Sodom was immediately plundered afterwards. Okay. Next section I want to point you to, Genesis 19. Okay, this is where we actually see the city being destroyed. There's some timing details and some location details that we want to make note of. Look at Genesis 19:15. This is after the angels warned Lot, get your relatives out of the city. If you have anybody you want to warn, tell them now. He tries to warn his sons-in-law, but they don't believe him. Then 19:15 says, when morning dawned, the angels urged Lot, saying, up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, or you'll be swept away in the punishment of the city. Okay, When is this? What time is this happening? This is very early, precisely at dawn. So this final exhortation to leave the city is at dawn. And then, you know, Lot has a little plea with the angel. He says, oh, I can't go where you want me to go. Hold on, let me make a request. Look down at verse 19 and 22. Verse 19. Now behold, your servant has found favor in your sight, and you have magnified your loving kindness, which you have shown me by saving my life. But I cannot escape to the mountains, for the disaster will overtake me, and I will die. Now behold, this town is near enough to flee to, and it is small. Please let me escape there. It's not small, that my life may be saved. He said to him, the angel replies, behold, I will grant you this request also, not to overthrow the town of which you have spoken. Hurry, escape there, for I cannot do anything until you arrive there. Therefore, the name of the town was called Zoar. Stop there for just a second. Lot asks the angels if he could flee to Zoar instead of the mountains. Why Zoar, according to Lot? Why that city? It's small, and it's close. He said it's near enough to flee to, and it's small. Please let me flee there. Angels grant the request, but they command Lot to hurry. Why? Danielle. That's right. They cannot do anything until he arrives in Zoar, which, by the way, maybe that puts a little light bulb in your head. All those paintings you see of like fire running down on Sodom as the group is running away, inaccurate, because they were already in Zoar when the fire came down. Also, the fire goes on more than just the city of Sodom. It's the whole valley, so there's that too. Notice the next verse, verse 19, or next two verses, 23 and 24. The sun had risen over the earth when Lot came to Zoar. Okay, whatever that means, the sun had risen over the earth, that's when he had arrived at Zoar. Then the Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. So some notes here. Also, Lot leaves Sodom at dawn. He goes to a nearby and small city named Zoar. The angels wait till Lot arrives to enact the judgment, and the sun had risen over the earth by that time. So sometime during the day, probably. One more background note. After Sodom is destroyed, Abraham looks, and he sees the smoke. Look down a couple of verses, verse 27 to 28. Now Abraham arose early in the morning, and he went to the place where he had stood before the Lord. And he looked down toward Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all the land of the valley, and he saw, and behold, the smoke of the land ascended like the smoke of a furnace. When does Abraham go to look at what happened to Sodom? Say that again. When he goes to look, he already sees that it's destroyed. Or soon after he goes to look, he sees that it's destroyed. When does he go to look? Text says, early in the morning. Okay, and he sees the smoke like the smoke of a furnace. Again, Abraham is able to see Sodom from his vantage point. Well, where is Abraham at this time? It doesn't say specifically here, it just says that he was in the same place that the Lord met him the day before. Well, where was that? If we back up a chapter, I won't make you do this, but in chapter 18, verse 1, it says, the Lord appeared to him by the oaks of Mamre. Okay, where are the oaks of Mamre? Well, use your little Bible app and do search, or use BibleGateway.com. Search the phrase oaks of Mamre, and the first place, or one of the places you run into it, is Genesis 13:18, which says, then Abram moved his tent and came and dwelt by the oaks of Mamre, which are in Hebron. And there he built an altar to the Lord. So there, putting these things together, we know that Abram was at Hebron, and he could see the valley's destruction from his vantage point. Okay. So those are the last set of notes. Abram looks early in the morning for what happened to Sodom, and he sees thick smoke, even from Hebron. So he's able to see it from Hebron. Now, we've got some very important background for assessing these claims. Which two sites are proposed as being for Sodom? Well, I'll show you. I don't know if you can see it that well, but there's the Dead Sea. To the northeast is a site called Tel El Hammam. Northeast of the Dead Sea, that is one site proposed for Sodom, and there are four other cities nearby that are proposed as the sites for the associated cities of Sodom. And then we have, to to the southeast, kind of on the eastern edge, the very bottom edge of the Dead Sea, another site proposed for Sodom, Bab Ed-Dra, on the southeast side of the Dead Sea. Which of these is the real Sodom? Which lines up better with the evidence? We're out of time for today. So just have to come back next time and find out. Ah, those cliffhangers. Let's close in prayer. If you have questions, come see me afterwards. Lord God, Lord, it's amazing that you have indeed acted in history. This is not removed from history. This is history. And we see it lining up with other pieces of history. But God, as I just think about a little bit of what we learned about Abraham and Sarah, that they were acting according to the customs of the time instead of trusting in you. Lord, I think that has application for us as well. Lord, I pray that we would not be conformed in the way that we think to the thinking of the world, that we would not be pressed into its mold. Lord, that our minds would be renewed with the scriptures by your Spirit, and that we would pay no attention to custom if it goes against your word. Lord, help us to believe. Help us have the faith that Abraham and Sarah later did demonstrate. Lord, thank you for your provision. Provide for the rest of the service today. Amen.